are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Much is known about American and European serial killers, but did you know that more than 150 homicidal maniacs have plagued the former Soviet Union during the last 100 years? Nicknamed the Night Creature, the Urals Strangler, or the Balashika Ripper in their native motherland, these sex fiends have committed some of the most heinous series of murders in the history of modern criminology. This book follows the stories of 25 maniacs unable to control their dark fantasies. They savagely tortured, strangled, stabbed, and defiled their victims in unspeakable ways. Illustrated with more than 200 photographs unearthed from the secret archives of retired police colonels and forensic psychiatrists, Russian Serial Killers, Volume 1, Maniacs, takes you on a true crime journey from the suburbs of Moscow to the frozen wastelands of Siberia. The book that we're featuring this evening is Russian Serial Killers, Volume 1, Maniacs, with my special guest, author and publisher, Nico Klo. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Nico Klo.
Thank you. Thank you for having me again.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on this extraordinary collection of serial killers. Right away, let's go to how you came to this idea, the origins of this idea, and the origins of this book.
In 2006, I was contacted by a Russian journalist who was working for a true crime magazine in Russia called Mir Kriminala, which means the criminal world. And so he wanted to interview me for his readers. The interview went really well. And after that, I've been intrigued by stories of Russian serial killers for years before that. And I had read, of course, about Andrei Chikatilo, the Rostov Reaper, but also about a few others, like the Chessbot Killer or the Hippopotamus. Some of those nicknames that we have read about in the West, but sometimes, you know, there's stories that we had never heard about. And the crazy thing is, when I mentioned my interest in Russian serial killers, this journalist sent me a PDF with over 100 names with photographs, and it was a list of all the Russian serial killers that he had listed. He himself was interested in publishing something in Russian about it, but he said that he didn't have the time, and even told me that Russian readers would not be interested in such a book. I was quite surprised because, of course, as a true crime buff, you know, I'm always looking for new stories and I want to know more. You know, the Chikatilo story is one of the craziest serial killer stories I've ever read.
Right.
And just the fact of knowing that there were like more than 99 killers, similar killers in Russian history, was mind-blowing. And so I had this list somewhere in my comp for years. Back in those days, I was working for a French publishing company called Camino. But my boss was not interested in covering those kind of cases. And it's not until last year when I created my own publishing company in English with English authors that I've decided to dig up this PDF file and to start doing some deep research in Russian websites, mostly. So most of them were written in Cyrillic. I have had a friend who is fluent in Russian, who helped me a lot, helped me find the right websites. And what's very interesting is that there is a lot of Russian websites which cover those cases, like we have in the West. So I was able to find plenty of photographs that were never published in the West before. And most important for me was to find articles and biographies of each of those killers. And this is how this book came to life, basically.
This is the volume one, and you plan to have three volumes. Now, tell us why that is. And the other thing is that you say that there's one thing shared by all the killers featured in this book. And what is that one thing that these killers all share?
Well, probably the thing that they all share, one of the things that they all share is that most of them, they are totally unknown in the West, except for Chikatilo and a few others. But for me, the important was to actually give life to those stories, because those stories, I think that they deserve to be known, they deserve to be available to a large audience, and they deserve to be, you know, each story is totally different from the other. But at the same time, you can actually see similar MOs, or I don't know, some of those killers have their equivalent in the West. And that's what I really found fascinating with those stories. As I told you, in this PDF file that I had, there were more than 100 names, and I had to narrow down for the purpose of a single book to 25, because I didn't want those books to be catalogs with short bios. For me, this is totally meaningless, useless. I wanted to develop each story, and each story did at least deserve at least 3 or 4 pages. Some of those stories, they cover more than 20 pages in the book. And I soon realized, of course, that I couldn't, you know, put 100 killers in one single book. It would be a 1,000 pages book. So I decided to split it in 3 volumes. The first volume is focusing on what the Russians call maniacs. This is the word that they have for this. It's short for sexual predators. The second volume will be on cannibals. So I've listed more than 20 cannibals in Russia. Wow. Most of them serial killers. So that's an impressive number.
Yes.
Of course, there's Chikatilo, but there's so many others that we have never heard of in the West. And this is the story that I am working on right now. And the third book will be focused on what they call in Russia the exterminators. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's people who kill victims who they think deserve to be killed because, for example, of their sexual orientation or because of their religion or their ethnicity. So, and surprisingly, those are the ones who have the biggest body counts.
Wow.
And yes, it's incredible. For example, the chessboard killer definitely belongs to that category of exterminators. So there will be 3 volumes. And the first volume, the book that we are talking about now and that I have released 2 months ago, is focusing on sex maniacs. And as you have seen while reading the book, there's a lot of different paraphilias throughout the books that are shown by these killers, whether it be fetishism, necrophilia, bondage, S&M. There's an entire wide spectrum of deviances. And I found this to be extremely intriguing.
You say that the one thing that is shared by all these killers as well, featured in this book, is their obsession for cruelty.
Oh, yes, yes.
Given that, let's go and go through the list of the 25 killers, yeah, starting with Boris Gusakov, then you call him the student hunter, and name the kills and also the number of kills, pardon me, and the dates that their murderous reign occurred.
So let's start with Boris Gusakov, the student hunter who killed in the late 60s. He killed 6 women. Then there is Nikolai Shestakov, the Lubaretsky maniac, who killed 12 victims in 1975 in the space of a year. We have Vladimir Sarampia. Forgive my accent. Of course, I'm not fluent in Russian. He only killed 2 people, and he was called the Alexandrovsky Ripper. We have Andrei Yevsev, killer of women in red. So he had this specific fetish with women who were dressing in the color red. He killed 9 women in the late 70s. He was also killed the kind-eyed killer, which is quite quite interesting as a nickname. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites in the books in terms of storytelling and the sheer body count with 19 kills in the late 80s is Sergei Yarkovsky, Balashikai Reaper, also nicknamed the Hippopotamus because of his size. Mm-hmm. This chapter has probably the most graphic pictures in the book.
Yes.
Then we have the Cemetery Maniac, Sergei Psukhanov, 8 killed during the 90s. We have Anatoly Nagiev, a very interesting one, the Pugacheva Stalker. He was obsessed with an actress and he killed women who looked like her. And he committed a massacre inside the train. He dumped the bodies from the moving train. It was a horrible sight. We have Igor Chernat, the evil spirit of Kavchevsky, with 4 kills. He was working in military grounds. He was killing in military grounds. We then have Igor Itilshov from St. Petersburg, the sadistic male prostitute with 9 victims. An interesting case also. After this, we have Sergei Shipilov, the Velsk Chikatilo. Let me just tell you about all those Chikatilo copycats, because that's quite interesting. Right after the Chikatilo case was covered by the media in early 90s, there was a lot of copycats in Russia, and each were nicknamed for example, if they were killing in the Velsk region, they were nicknamed the Velsk Chikatilo. So Sergei Shipilov killed, for example, 14 victims in the late 90s, 4 or 5 years after the last victim of Andrei Chikatilo. We have one of the most interesting cases in the book, in my opinion, Anatoly Slivko, also known as the Honored Torturer, with 7 kills between 1964 and 1985. After this, we moving to Vladimir Mukhankin, another Chikatilo copycat, nicknamed the Pupil of Chikatilo, with 9 kills in 1995, 9 murders in the space of 1 year. Then we have Boris Serebryakov, the Night Creatures. The Night Creature, he was killing in the late 60s. And what's interesting with him is that he had a very similar MO to Richard Ramirez. He would break and enter into homes and kill the persons while they were sleeping. It's a very interesting case. So it was not called the Night Stalker, but the Night Creature. This also is really interesting. Then we have Anatoly Utkin, Ulyanovsky Maniac, 9 kills between 1968 and 1973. And Vladimir Uzov, the Boy Hunter, 5 kills between 74 and 75. Vladimir Vinichevsky, it's a really old case from the 30s, 1938, 1939, and he killed 8 boys. He was, you know, not really older than his victims, but as a teenager, one of the youngest serial killers in Russia. Then we have Nikolai Fefilov, the Kontrolnaya Strangler, 7 kills in the 80s. We have Vasily Kulik, the Irkutsk Monster. He was a doctor who killed his victims in 1984 and 1986. Very interesting case too. And now it's time to talk about Russia's most prolific serial killer with 78 victims. A totally crazy body count.
Yes.
Yeah. He killed them between 1992 and 2010. His name is Mikhail Popkov, was also known as the Werewolf of Siberia, or the Angarsk Maniac. He was a policeman, so it was easy for him to actually leave no trace, no clue whatsoever. And this is why he killed so many people. Then we have Alexander Bezilov, the Night Demon. Oleg Kuznetsov, the Balashikai Reaper, 10 victims in between 91 and 92. One of the most interesting now, Sergei Tash, Pavlov Had Maniac, also known as the Borovsky Maniac. 37 victims between 1980 and 2005, so nearly 25 years without being arrested. He also was a policeman. There is a lot of photos also in this chapter. We are near the end with the well-known Dnepropetrovsk maniacs. You probably have heard of them because they did a video, very extremely graphic snuff video, filming themselves while they were killing a homeless person with hammers and knives. This was leaked, and you could find those videos in websites such as Orgrish.com back in those days. They killed 21 homeless people in the space of 2 months in 2007. Incredible.
Yes.
Incredible. Incredible. So that's not the last case in the book. The last case is actually Bakhtyor Matyakubov, also known as the Uzbek Chikatilo. Another really interesting case. He was nicknamed the maniac in white gloves because he would always wear white gloves while committing his crimes. So, yes, this is the list of the 25 killers that are featured in this book. Most of those cases are illustrated by dozens of photos. I tried to write the definitive book on those cases. It has never been done before. And I wanted this series of books to be the reference on the subject.
Before we start going and specifically exploring the specifics of some of these crimes from these killers, because they're quite interesting as case studies themselves, you explained too, and you touched on it in terms of the government and the police not acting like we had seen the golden age of serial killers treated in America with the media all a frenzy. So as you write in the book, explain the situation in Russia in terms of the politics and the media and their attitude towards admitting that there was a problem and there were serial killers in Russia.
So half of the cases that I cover in this book were committed before 1989. As you know, 1989 was the date when the Soviet Empire collapsed.
Right.
And it was also the year when the crimes of Chikatilo became to receive international coverage. What was happening during the Soviet period? There was a lot of crimes, of course. And what's surprising is that there was as many crimes, serial murders in the USSR than in America at the same time. In the 70s, in the 60s, there's even serial killers in the 30s in Russia. But those crimes were deliberately not talked about. When the police would find out that they had a serial killer on the loose in their province or in their local town, they would alert the higher authorities, but they would not communicate to the press. So all those cases, they just would not be covered by the national press at all. You must understand that crime in general and serial murder, of course, were considered as typically Western evils. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things were not supposed to happen in the Soviet Republic. So when a case implying several murders and sex murders was investigated by the local police, they would try to find as soon as possible a possible suspect. They would torture the suspect until he would confess to the crimes, even if he was nowhere near the crime scenes. And then they would say, okay, we've got, the suspect, we've got the person who's guilty. He was sent to prison, usually killed before he would even go on trial. And they would try to just, cover the case. And it's only when local people would find out that there would be other victims in their community that they would actually not call the local police because they did not even trust them anymore. So they would try to alert the higher instances, the people at the Soviet party who were, above the police bureaucracy of the local town.
Right.
So this is why those crimes, they were just put under carpet. They were locked inside a cupboard. There were skeletons in the closet, basically, of the Russian regime. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, journalists began to have access to police archives. And they found out that there was a lot of cases that they had never heard about before. So they began to cover those cases. And this is when they began to publish true crime magazine, detective magazines, which most of them were created in the 90s. And they would cover those cases. But at the same time, it still was considered as something that was typically Western and American. Words themselves, serial killer, was never used when covering those cases. They would talk about maniacs. That's the word that they liked when describing those kind of cases. Chikatilo, of course, it was impossible to cover the case, hide the case, I mean. So this is when they actually began to talk about, to cover the cases when it was impossible to hide anymore. This is when they covered such cases as the chessboard killer or the hippopotamus, because there were so many victims that it was just impossible to hide.
What's fascinating in this book, too, is that I've read numerous accounts of the police overreach and overstepping and using the third degree before Miranda warnings legislation in America.
Oh, yeah.
But this book is rife with wrongful conviction by virtue of wrongful confessions, by virtue of outright torture and beatings of suspects.
Yes, police brutality at its worst. And they would even pay convicts inside the prisons to actually kill suspects for them so that there would be no trial. It was easier for them. And this was their way to hide their own failure as an investigative team. So yes, it was really hard times. It was, for example, when we're talking about murders in the gay community, of course, they would target people who were considered by the state as enemies of the state because of their sexual orientation. There were some innocent people who ended up in jail or were killed because they were wrongly accused. It's a sad reality, but that's definitely what used to happen in those days in the Soviet Republic.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Skylight Frames. The holidays are just around the corner. Looking for a good gift idea that your parents or in-laws will genuinely love? It's hard to find meaningful gifts for family members, especially parents and grandparents who seem to have everything. Well, Skylight is the perfect gift. My parents love this Skylight frame. My daughter sends them photos of her and her fiancé's travels, and my brother and his sons send photos from all over the country. Skylight Frame is a photo frame you can update instantly by email from anywhere. Sending photos to Skylight is effortless. Everyone in the family can use the app or just email them to the Skylight and they'll pop up in seconds. Its timeless black frame with a white mat adds a beautiful touch to your home. Choose from two size options, either the original 10-inch or new large 15-inch frame. It's so simple that even my non-tech-savvy mom and dad could set it up and use it. Now, as a special offer, you can get $15 off your purchase of a Skylight frame when you go skylightframe.com and enter code SHOCKING. That's right. To get $15 off your purchase of a Skylight frame, just go skylightframe.com, enter code SHOCKING. That's SKYLIGHT. frame.com, code SHOCKING. Now, Nico, I want to use this opportunity to explore some of the stories of the 25 incredible serial killers that you feature in this collection, just to demonstrate the uniqueness and the some of the parallels that we think that are unique, or some of the things that we think are unique and exclusive to American serial killers, those legendary ones that we regard the golden age of serial killing. These Russian serial killer, these counterparts have bizarre and extraordinary parallels with some of the most famous and legendary serial killers in American and world true crime history. So let's go through just a few of those, but I wanted to talk about Anatoly Slivko, and whose nickname is the Honored Torturer or the Counselor Ripper. Let's talk a little bit about him.
It is one of the most bizarre cases he featured in the book, definitely. It's a case that I had never heard about. I had heard rumors about Russian serial killers who was filming snuff movies, but I had never had a name before. And it's only when I covered the case that I realized that this was the one. This was actually the Russian serial killers who was actually filming his own murders. And the craziest thing about it is that it happened in the 60s. So there is a little bit of we have to cover is the thing that sparked his fantasy life because it's really interesting. So let me get back to the book for the specific details.
You write that in 1961, while he was in the Far East, he witnessed an accidental death of a man who crashed his motorbike. And he had hit several teens with the motorcycle and injured one, and one died right on the spot. Tell us what he experienced.
Exactly. So when this happened, he was sexually aroused. So it was the beginning of his sex life. And he later recalled the accident. He said the boy had experienced convulsions in his death throes as the smell of gasoline and fire permeated the air. What was really specific of the boy that he had seen die before, that this boy was wearing a Boy Scout uniform. So Russia, well, the Soviet Union, had its own system of Boy Scouts, and they had a specific uniform with the tie and special shoes. And when Slivko became an adult, he managed to find a job as a counselor in a youth club, one of the local chapters of the Boy Scouts. And this is when he decided to film some of his pupils playing reenactments, war reenactments. So there were little short films where he told them to basically play, for example, the German invaders. The other kids would play the Russian, their Russian enemies. And sometimes he would stage executions, which is quite concerning, knowing that those kids were, some of them were 14, 15, even younger than that. And he would actually film them a noose around their neck and staging fake executions. He would film them that. But soon this was not enough for him because he wanted to relive this very first incident that he had witnessed. So he would take them one by one and he would tell them to reenact those execution scenes, except that this time he would actually strangle them with a rope or drown them or kill them with ropes and several torture instruments. All this was shot on 16 millimeter. When the police actually arrested him, they found those reels and they found out that he had killed, I will tell you the exact number, he had killed seven young boys between 1964 and 1985. So what probably the most terrifying thing, this murder case, is that you actually find photograph stills of those snuff films online. And, I even have heard of people who have seen those films. Of course, they suffered from PTSD after watching those films.
Sure.
Because they were extremely intense. Mm. But yes, some of those stills, you can actually still find them. Slivko was arrested and they found many uniforms inside the youth club. It's definitely a very bizarre case, not only because the fact that he had this very specific fantasy life, but also the fact that he was using the system and his position as a counselor of the Boy Scouts lure his victims into his own fantasy world. And yes, that's what really intrigued me about the case.
It's interesting that he conducts these films and gets these kids to put a noose around their neck. And a lot of them, you write, or most of them, have some sort of amnesia from the experience. They don't even really know what exactly happened. And then he masturbates over them, films them in all kinds of bizarre poses.
Exactly.
You say that this occurred for 22 years. He filmed 43 boys, but so he killed only seven. But there was, you say that urge that he had to relive that experience with the accident. And so then he would kill and dismember these young boys and pour gasoline on the remains and light them on fire to relive the fatal car accident he had witnessed. And that's when you write, when, again, it's always a cliche, the hardened detective, but when they actually saw the films that this guy made, mm-hmm. they made an extraordinary statement in your book that you quote, that there was no, and in effect, what he said was there was no horror movie author that could come anywhere near what he had seen and what he had experienced just watching those films.
Totally. The fact that he committed all those crimes for so long, and the fact that his fantasy life was so specific. He also had this thing with shoes, he would cut their shoes in half because of this car accident that he had witnessed. He had seen blood splattering the shoes. He wanted to recreate this image of blood on shiny shoes. It was extremely specific in terms of psychiatry, psychology. It's a very unique case, very unique case.
Yeah.
It reminded me of Jerry Brudos, the foot fetish part. But yes, the fact that the detectives were so shocked by the videos themselves, it tells you a lot. Yeah.
You say that too, that they discovered the killer diary, and where he talks about trying to attempt to try to control the urges, but that they overcame him. But he did say about the recordings that he made, he said he didn't want people to see the videotapes. He said the recording is disgraceful for the human race. He says it can't be washed away or forgotten. And he said, I'm scared that other people will watch it. So it gave him some incredible kind of insight to his own mania.
He even said that if you ever watch those tapes, you will regret it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's crazy. Mm. But at the same time, he was reminding them that they were actually arresting a deputy of the city council. So he still was holding on to his position as a respectable member of the Soviet Party, which is reminiscent of Chikatilo, who was also a prominent member of the Soviet parties. At the same time, there's this fact of being discovered, but he was still clenching on his position as a respectful member of the community, which is amazing.
You mentioned Chikatilo, and that comes up in this story as well, is because very much reminiscent of the fictitious movie Silence of the Lambs and Clara Starling, as you write, that he was asked, this killer was asked for his cooperation and to help police in their investigation of Andrei Chikatilo. Very, very interesting.
Yes, he was visited by the investigators of the case. They were hoping that he would help them understand the psychology of Chikatilo. But what he gave them could not be used for the actual investigation. So yes, it was useless at the end.
Mm. Yes. Let's talk about and discuss Sergei Tak. Am I mispronouncing his name?
And yes, it's hard to pronounce his name.
The Pavlograd maniac. And you talk about, in this case, background, as you do, of all of these perpetrators. The one thing I found that's almost common thread through almost the 25 stories is that many of these perpetrators, in the beginning when they were young, they were sickly, they were timid, they were antisocial or unsociable or bullied. That kind of portrayal of almost all of these killers seemed to be that they were in that unenviable situation or position when they were young.
Yes, yes. Cash was also a victim of bullying because he was physically weak. He had to undergo treatment. He had to see a psychiatrist because of it. So he engaged in weightlifting to gain some muscle, trying to gain some confidence. He really was involved into sports, but he had a sports injury, so he had to end his career in sports. So he chose instead to join the army. So later on, he eventually became a police officer, and he investigated his own crimes. So that's one of the crazy things about those kind of cases. Yeah, he was extremely prolific, this serial killer, 37 victims.
Mm-hmm. You say, too, that he started off working for the police, but of course, he gravitated towards being a forensic expert, which helped him in all his investigations and helped him compete with his fellow colleagues, policemen, didn't he?
Yeah, he had access to top secret materials, and he would read them all, read all the cases. He would try to find out about how criminals usually get arrested, so he could, improve his technique, his murder techniques.
You write, too, that he was perpetrating, and he had left a gray hair on one of his 13-year-old victim, but the police ignored that evidence and framed an innocent person that didn't even have gray hair, you write. And again, what we mentioned already about how that confession came about through a beating. And so despite them thinking that they have this perpetrator behind bars, the killings continued, didn't they?
Exactly. And Dayton threatened this man to kill his own daughter. This is why he confessed. You can imagine police officers threatening to kill members of your family. So this man was terrorized and he had no other option than to confess. So yes, those kind of cases, they're really typical of what was going on back in those days in Russia concerning those type of crimes.
You write that this man was distraught from being accused of this murder of his daughter, and obviously the murder of his daughter contributed to this, and he committed suicide in his cell. And then after that, the villagers weren't still satisfied. They released the anger on this person's wife and set her house on fire numerous times. And she lost her job and lost her career. And so, again, he continued killing and nobody making the connection that this perpetrator was on the loose. As you say, for many conditions in terms of the media not being informed, the police not wanting to admit, and certainly any politician not wanting to admit that there was anything awry going on.
They would never admit they had failed because it was a very hierarchic organization. There was always the fear of ending up in jail because you were a bad investigator, basically. So this is why they tried to frame so many people for those murders.
Yes, you're right that over 10 people were accused and convicted, wrongfully accused and sent to prison. 10 people, and it's extraordinary. And as you write, not one policeman was ever reprimanded or lost their job as a result.
Exactly, because that would be bad press for the system. In those countries, in these communist systems, it was always a case of sacrificing the individuals for the party, the sake of the party. So this is why even though they knew that they had the wrong suspect, they would do everything to have them in jail or killed before their trial so that they would think that the case would be closed. And even if the real killer was still killing again, they would blame it on another killer and not admit that it was the same person committing those crimes over and over again.
This Pavlograd maniac, like parallels to the most infamous serial killers in America, to add to this incredible story, he attends the funeral. And there, someone recognizes him from the last attack where the students had been swimming and he used it as an opportunity to attack this 9-year-old and she survived.
Yeah.
And so soon after, because he was recognized and because he was foolish enough and audacious enough to attend the funeral of his last victim, he was arrested. And then, as you write, soon after, as many of these perpetrators, almost all of them, they soon confess, seemingly willingly, and cooperate with the authorities. He draws an accurate map of where his crimes occurred.
Totally.
But then you find out, as we mentioned, what the motivation for all of this murder, maybe not primarily, but quite a bit of the motivation for these murders was what? Concerning his colleagues.
Oh, he wanted to get even at his colleagues and show them that he was better than them. He wanted to prove them that by killing people, he was smarter than his colleagues. That's a really weird way of trying to prove it. But at the same time, that's what his logic was.
He also compared himself to, again, Chikatilo and said, just like Chikatilo, I'm a beast. I'm not a man. I'm a beast. And then again, very much like these infamous characters in the US, the story doesn't end as well because now you read about this forum, the fantasy forum that these Russian girls and Ukrainian girls and women are interested in. It's called the World of Maniacs. Tell us.
That was fascinating when I found out this underground community that they have in Russia, because we have similar things in Europe and the US, of course. There's what hybristophilia, which is the sexual attraction to criminals. Of course, when you look at people like Ted Bundy or Richard Ramirez and the number of groupies that would write them when they were in prison, it's something that I thought was only happened in the West. When I did my research on this specific case, I found out that there was this community, online community in Russia with groupies trying to not only write criminals, but also trying to marry them. It's some kind of weird competition between each other, between who will be the first to marry this or that very famous criminals that's in the news. It's extremely weird. In the case of Tkach, it was a really young woman who was at least 30 years younger than him. And she even posted selfies of herself on the murder sites with other fans of this serial killer. And she married him in jail. And she even had a son with him, which is even weirder.
Yes, absolutely. The story, again, it shares some characteristics, but then really does outdo almost any other profile I've heard of a serial killer. So very, very interesting serial killer. One of the very, very fascinating ones that you have featured in this book. Let's talk about, before I let you go, the Sergei Rykakovsky, or the Balashika Ripper. From 88, he operated to 1993, and his nickname was the Hippopotamus because of his huge size.
His size of his huge frame. He would kill in a park, much like the chessboard killer. He would specially target homosexuals. He had an hatred towards gay people because of his own insecurity. And he would also target homeless people. There was a lot of mutilation involved in those crimes, a lot of hatred. And I would compare his attacks to the crimes of Peter Sutcliffe in a way, because of the sheer brutality of the crimes and the blunt trauma, mutilation, disembowelment. He killed 19 people. Notable thing about this killer is the fact that he wrote a novel during the crimes, a very strange sci-fi novel that was used during his trial for the insanity plea. But yes, he was convicted and sent to life to prison. And he died in 2007 of tuberculosis, like many Russian prisoners. This kind of disease is widespread in Russian prisons.
You write that he claimed that he had a hatred for gays from being raped in prison after he had obviously raped older women. And what he also did was impale people and used objects. So like a ski pole, he used improvised items he would use. And also, was typical with many of the stories, almost all of the stories, was that they would visit the crime scene again, these killers. And also many, many of these are necrophiles, including this Sergei here, the hippopotamus necrophile. But also, and again, he shared this with a couple other perpetrators that attacked older women and had a paraphilia about that, but also wouldn't contain himself to just older women, would attack young children. And many of these killers are included in this book and their heinous crimes because many of these perpetrators, and we didn't get into that, but there are many killers that concentrated on little girls, didn't they?
I wouldn't go as far as to say that it was a typical of Russian serial killers, but yes, there is a very high percentage of the molesters in the book. Yes, the fact that it was maybe easier for them to approach this type of vulnerable victims because they weren't cautious. Their parents didn't warn them about getting candy from strangers, I think. So, no, in Russia, it was a different kind of approach to crime, and crime did not exist for the general public. It was something that happened in the West, but not in Russia. So maybe that's why so many of those offenders did have such a high body count. Yeah.
Well, you're right, too, that there was no media to report. So they're very much unlike America, where the papers were ablaze with headlines and looking for stories, and they were hungry for headlines. These crimes weren't reported, so the parents weren't really to blame too much if the two-year-old was outside just standing alone for 10 or 15 minutes because they weren't warned. They didn't have any idea from the police nor the media. It was a different time with no social media, so they had no idea.
Yeah, it was different times. again, it was a different system, a different way of thinking, a different approach to investigation, to police investigation. They did not, of course, have access to modern DNA research techniques. It was the old fingerprinting system, and that was about it. So, of course, some of them were aware of what was happening in the West. They did not have the resources, the funds, maybe the motivation, because as I said before, they were bureaucrats. They were not really involved in those cases, especially when the victims were homeless or were gays or were sex workers. The police just didn't care.
There was a fair amount. There's a few stories where the killer has the insight and the psychologists and the professionals that interview them after their trials or for the trials themselves included that there was these specific traumatic events, like we had mentioned, where that person had a sexual experience watching a car accident where someone died. But there was other things where a lot of these perpetrators did some service in the military. So whatever horrors that they witnessed in their service or whatever horrors were allowed and condoned in the name of war, it seems that there is some contribution, because the level of depravity and again, the heinous nature of these serial killers, it seems to be that there has to be some contribution.
Totally. The fact of working and being a military was definitely a help for them. And some of them even killed on military grounds, which is unbelievable.
And also you have the other, again, many killers will gravitate towards the police. And so you have two prominent stories in this book, for sure, certainly, where policemen are the perpetrators, and that really helps their murderous careers, doesn't it?
Definitely. There were a couple of them who were investigating their own crimes, and they had access to a lot of resources, so they could actually know the mistakes they had done on several of the crime scenes. So they would try everything in their power to leave false clues on the crime scenes. So this is why they were so prolific, because they had the tools in their hands to just raise their tracks.
Yes, certainly. And the conditions that we mentioned and we talked about today, the political and then the societal situation, contributed to these reign of terror going on much longer, the wrongful conviction and in some cases execution of people wrongfully convicted for these killers' crimes. It is a shocking collection of stories that you have put together. I want to thank you very much for coming on and talking about this book, Russian Serial Killers, Volume 1, Maniacs. You were a guest on this show, True Murder, with your book, Gospel of Blood. For those that might want to take a look at other work and your publishing company, tell us how they might find out more information.
So I run a publishing company called Serial Pleasures Publishing. I have published more than a dozen books on such topics as Jonestown, Jim Jones, Richard Ramirez. It's a book called Legions of the Night Stalker. It's about his fans and the people who used to visit him. There is a book on the psychiatric reports on Jeffrey Dahmer. So it's the total psychiatrist reports that were done before the trial.
Right.
There is also a book on his correspondence, several people before he was murdered in prison. It's called Dead Dahmer. There's a few other books which are similar in vein. And of course, I'm still working on the second and third volume of Russian Serial Killers, which might become eventually a series. Maybe I will focus on South American killers one day, or Southeast Asian serial killers, because it's also a fascinating topic.
Absolutely. We look forward to the second volume of Russian Serial Killers, Maniacs.
Yeah, the second edition will be about cannibals. So 20 stories or more
about cannibals.
Cannibalism.
Yes, looking forward to that. Thank you so much, Nico Klo, Russian Serial Killers, Volume 1, Maniacs. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.